C, Java, Lisp, Ruby, Python, Prolog, Scheme. These are programming languages, the ones you use in order to code. But real computer scientists see more than just that.
The Computer Science Software Engineering College Courses Review Podcast, where we describe the core courses that all aspiring computer scientists and software engineers should take on their college path. And now your host, Andres Arriaga.
Welcome back, guys. Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for the patience and for all the time that you've been waiting for another episode. I know I have been such an idiot and really just haven't got the time, but that's an excuse, of course. I really ran out of energy for the podcast for a little while. And at the same time, I had a lot of things going on in my life. I had the internship at my first job at the first tech company that I ever worked at. And after that, well, you know, different last projects, last homeworks, things that I had to do in order to graduate. Thank goodness that I am able to graduate now. However, because of the current situation of the coronavirus, well, any sort of celebrations or events that brought together a lot amount of people, well, got canceled or postponed. So I haven't had, you know, the actual piece of paper in my hand, but I am graduated officially through digital justifications or whatever. But yeah, so all of that happened. Now I'm working at Fiserv, the number one fintech in the whole world, and I'm super glad. I'm really glad I'm doing that. I'm taking a role more of a PM sort of type of deal. Implementation specialist is the name of the role. And we basically help clients to migrate from one version of a software that they use in banks and financial institutions to let people into their system and make it easy for them to buy financial products. So we basically manage that software that helps all of them do that. And at the same time, I have the role of a more logistical type of space that I'm working at. And here I have to not only assign work to people that I have under my supervision, but I also have to work with other colleagues so that we can all get the vast majority of those implementations completed. So that's kind of like super summarized of what's happened in my life. But any case, anyhow, I think that something that made me realize that I had to continue the podcast were some amazing comments and questions from you guys. They really gave me the hopes and the energy to continue to do this, and I really thank you from the very bottom of my heart. You make me really happy. But anyway, today is a really special day, not only because we are coming back with the podcast, but because we have a special guest. Da, 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 da. And that's for later. But not only that as well, we really have a special episode because this is a special course. It is one course that clears up a lot of things. And it's also one of the things that if you get to know correctly, it'll make you stand out as a real engineer, as a professional who knows his crap. And what is that exactly? Well, it is the programming languages. And I know what you are probably thinking. How can there be a course that only describes different types of programming languages? I mean, really, I could Google that in a second. Well, but the difference here is that this course, if it is taught correctly, shouldn't really dive deep into current programming languages. It should double down on the principles that guide programming in general. And if you think about it, our industry is constantly changing, meaning that programming languages are destined to change over time or just die altogether. And if you don't believe me, then look at the numerous past programming languages that are pretty much extinct. There are others, however, which led to the creation of new languages. The point here is that if you are going to take a course that goes over the newest, hottest programming languages, well, that's great, you know. You need to renew tactics in life and adapt to the new tendencies. But it's a course that is supposed to give you fundamentals, principles. Then it doesn't really do a good job because things are always changing. That is exactly what this course tries to tackle, the principles of programming altogether, which will not change in the long run, or will most probably not change in the long run. And I say that because you never know when quantum computers will take over the world. Well, let's hope they do someday, and let's hope we're all ready for it. But these principles are known as fundamental paradigms, and that's what I'm talking about. The paradigms of programming languages. They are like different ways of thinking when you program. You also learn some of the most relevant theory of language design, but that is pretty much secondary. What you have to learn in this course is the different approach, different ways to think and to program that are pretty much completely different from imperative to, example, functional, or functional to object-oriented, or object-oriented to logical. But okay, let's just get right into the paradigms themselves. We will use one or more programming languages that belong to each paradigm as examples. And just to clarify, there are four. I mentioned them already, but they are object-oriented programming, imperative programming, logical programming, and functional programming. Now, since we have already tackled object-oriented programming and imperative programming, indirectly, of course, I won't give them that much time. I'll give them more time to the weird, not-so-common paradigms that you might not find pretty much in the real, normal, common world. And we're going to talk more about that in just a little while. But okay, let's start with functional paradigms, okay? So first, we have the functional way of thinking of coding. And what is the first thing that pops into your mind when you hear functional paradigm? Well, for me, it's as just I have described, the functions in themselves. You know, like the ones we learned about in Introduction to Programming. And functions have an input, an output, and they serve as little modules for bigger functions. A really interesting and different thing about pure functional languages is that they don't have variables. You have to play around with inputs and outputs in order to obtain static representations of different structures like matrices or graphs or any other type of complex data structure. So, for example, for this paradigm, we will be using the functional language scheme. And for those of you who don't know, which could be very well the vast majority of you all, Scheme is a dialect of Lisp, L-I-S-P, Lisp. Now, Lisp is a programming language that was invented by none other than John McCarthy, one of the fathers of artificial intelligence. He had to process a lot of lists in his line of work, so he created a programming language called Lisp, which comes from list processor. Now, in theory, the first functional programming language was Lambda Calculus, which is really a framework, mainly. And it was created by Alonzo Church, a mentor of Alan Turing, the legend. What this framework tries to do is to encapsulate all the possible expressions and problems into mathematical functions. And if it can be transformed and solved, then it is said that the problem is computable. So we're talking about super old stuff here. And this is my point, exactly. Functional programming languages are simple, are really super simple, but extremely powerful for complex computation. In any case, in Scheme, you have two main functions that help you manage lists. They are CAR and CDR. I like to call them CAR and CUDOR, respectively. There's another function called the CONS, C-O-N-S, and it's for creating those lists. Now, I'm going to kind of give you guys a super quick approach of how functional programming languages work. In functional programming, you basically work with lists all the time. I mean, in Scheme, of course. So if you're going to work with lists the vast majority of time, that means that you need functions that are oriented in order to manage those lists accordingly. So for example, CAR, C-A-R, what it does, it's that it gets or it pops the first element of the list that you have at hand. CUDOR, C-D-R, what it makes is that it returns not the first, but all the other elements of the list. And CONS, as I just mentioned, it constructs lists. With those three main functions, you can create a lot of stuff. And why is that the case? Well, think about this. In functional programming, we don't have return with a loop type of deal. We always use recursion. What was recursion is what basically you call the same function that you are inside of. So you are, for example, inside of a function that tests to see if there is a certain element in a list. And what you would have to do is that at the very beginning, you would have to take the list and say, okay, is the list empty? If it's empty, then it means that the element was not in the list. And why? Well, because we're going to get that in a little second. After that one instruction, you have to take out the first element of the list at hand. That means the first element of the list as the parameter. And we do that with a car. Now, if we find that that element was exactly the same as the one that we're trying to look for, then we return true. However, if we can't find it, the third instruction would be to run again the function, but with the parameter of CUDOR list. That means the same list, but without the first element. And if you can tie all these knots together, you'll see that what we're basically doing is we're asking, is the list empty? Then is the first element of the list actually the element? And then, hey, if it's not the element, run this function again, but with the rest of the list. And what that'll do is that eventually, if the element is inside of that function, then it will find it because it will fall into the second category. And of course, the list won't be empty. But if the element is not in the list, actually, then what will happen is that in one of those iterations that it calls itself, it'll call itself with an empty list because the last time that you were inside of that function, well, you only had one element. And that one element, when you run it through CUDOR, it'll return you an empty list, meaning that when you go again, it'll fall into the first if statement. If this list is empty, return false. And that's why it's so simple yet so different to work with Lisp and any type of programming language that derives from Lisp. It uses a lot of lists and it uses only functions. And this is the funny thing. If you want to create static data structures, just like in an imperative paradigm, for example, you have to think ahead of time and use the data structures on the go. Remember, we don't have variables here. This means that if you want to search inside of a matrix, you first program a function that creates the matrix with the cons function that we learned before, right? So you create the function that creates the matrix, and then you call that function on the parameter of a function you use to search for the matrix. Since you can't have variables in this paradigm, you will have to compute and calculate everything you need on the fly. For obvious reasons, if you want to work with static data structures, then this paradigm is not really going to be really useful for you. However, for computing lists of data, this paradigm and its language is excellent. This works particularly well with computer science subjects, since vectors are used almost always to optimize algorithms. And remember, guys, that I told you that in this episode we were going to have a really special guest? Well, guess what? For the next subject, which would be logical paradigms, we will have a cool, important guest called Justin. He is a friend of mine. He studies computer science at the University of Costa Rica. And I know I can tell you guys from the very bottom of my heart that this guy knows his stuff. This guy breathes computation and spews out software. That's what he does. So really, guys, I'm just going to let Justin speak from now on.
Hello, everybody. My name is Justin. And I was kindly invited to the show today because your usual host, Andres, seems to think I'm somewhat of an authority on logic programming. I have no idea what made him think that, but I'm glad to be here and I'll try my best. Just to briefly introduce myself, I'm 21. I've been working on programming, creating databases, software development, and last but not least, computer science for the last 7 years. I especially like machine learning and everything related to data science. So it may be stereotype, but most people I've met that work on software engineering really like practical knowledge. They really like practical things. They like learning about things that are useful and help them solve problems. They will learn things like JavaScript and HTML and CSS and Microsoft tools such as Visual Studio, SQL Server, C#, because in all honesty, that's what pays in the end. There's where the money's at. So yeah, it's a very honest approach. The computer science guys, on the other hand, really seem to like to complicate their own lives, me included. They sometimes seem to like learning more arcane languages or subjects. They like a little bit of more obscure knowledge with questionable real-world usage. That may just be why I love logic languages so much. The logic paradigm is very different from the other languages or paradigms you may be familiar with. By now, you're probably aware of the object-oriented programming paradigm. You have probably used either Java or Python, C++, or some other modern language. They are all pretty much the same. Logic programming, also known as rule-based programming, is very different from those languages. In logic language such as Prolog, PROLOG, which is short for logic programming, first we have to make clear that it predates many of the concepts that are regularly used in other programming languages. Prolog was created in 1972, the same year as the C programming language, which is the base for many programming languages we use today. So, C is like knowing Latin for an English major student, because C predated C++, and of course, Java takes a lot from it, and Python does too. So C is very important. That same year was also the same the year that Smalltalk was created. And Smalltalk, I don't know if you've heard of it, but it was the first programming language to introduce object-oriented programming. It was a great year for programming, but the creation year is pretty much the only thing that these three languages have in common. In Prolog, you are not going to be doing for loops, for example, nor while loops, nor any loops for that matter. Let's not even think about doing something like a for each loop. There are no objects at all. There are no functions. There are no variables. Not even flow control with if-else statements in the same way that other paradigms use it. To be fair, there are some things that are similar to variables. There are some things that work like if-else statements. There are things that are similar to functions, but they really don't work the same way or are used the same way. So the things that are present in a logic programming language are rules, facts, queries. In order to explain what rules and predicates are, or facts, and how they form the language, we first have to talk about data types, of which there are only two. There are atoms and there are lists. Atoms could be compared to simple variables. An int could be an atom, a double, or any other number. They are atoms. A character would also be an atom. If there's only one thing, then it's an atom. It's very simple. Something like a vector or an array that has several ints or several separate characters, that could be a list. Now, what are facts? In logic programming. Well, facts are what we tell the computer to be true. For example, if we want to make a program that recognizes everything that is round, we can say that the earth is round. And the syntax for that in Prolog would be round, open parenthesis, earth, close parenthesis, period. The period is very important, don't forget it. And that would be telling the program that the earth is round. Or when someone asks you if the earth is round, then you return true. Then we can say that everything that is round has a radius. So we would write that as has radius, open parenthesis, x, close parenthesis. Then there are two symbols that are very important. They go together. Is colon dash. Column dash. And that means f. So has radius, open parenthesis, x, or any other name of the variable. We will call it x in this case. Close parenthesis, column dash, round, open parenthesis, x, close parenthesis, period. And here we are making a rule. So we're saying that something has a radius if it is round. So that would be a rule. The first one, so facts are actually also rules, just are rules that are always true. For example, we in the first one, saying round earth, it's the same as saying round, the earth is round if true, which is always true. True always evaluates true, right? So with these two lines, then we could say exclamation mark, that has a radius earth, that. And if we run that program, then it would say true, because the program will say, okay, the earth is round. Okay, so everything that is round has a radius. Okay, so that is true. The earth has a radius. And that's a very simple example. It's also very easy to make a program to determine if someone is my ancestor. So for example, I can say that anyone is an ancestor of someone else if it's their father or their mother. So if we create those two rules, and then we also say that an ancestor is, well, we add transitivity. So for example, the ancestor of my father is also my ancestor. Then we give a couple of examples. So for example, there is Mary, and her father was named Joe. And, you know, Mary had a son that was named Arriaga. Then if we ask if Arriaga has ancestors, then it will say yes. It would have two ancestors. They would actually be Joe and Mary. And if we give it more examples, it will evaluate to every single person that is an ancestor of him. So that's a very neat thing of programming languages such as Prolog. You write very few lines of code. They're not the easiest lines of code to write, but they're very powerful because the language will do everything that is necessary for it to run and to evaluate everything to either true or false, or take all the examples that, you know, just satisfy the rules that you've given it. There's also something called union or unification. That's where you can combine two atoms into one. So the way that happens is if they are the same atom. So for example, you take X and X, they can be unified. The other way that can happen is if the first variable is free, a free variable, which means it hasn't been unified with anything else. And the second one is an atom. So if you unify the two of them, they can do it. They are unified. If both are free variables, they will be unified. What this is useful for is that you can take several separate characters and you can unify them into a single atom. So, for example, you can take A and you can take B, and their atoms, you unify them, and they are now the same thing. This is useful because that's a way you can make strings. And many problems can be solved with unification, or you can unify lists so that you can have all the ancestors that are male and all the ancestors that are female, or things like that. There are so many things related to logic programming languages, and we could make a whole podcast just out of that, or a couple of chapters at least. But for now, I think you have the basic knowledge of logic languages. They're super powerful. They are not used that much, but for evaluating things that are true or are not true, or retrieving data from very big lists, they're very fast, and you don't have to write too much code for them to work. So thank you for having me. Hopefully, I'll be in other episodes, and always keep learning.
Yes, keep learning, guys. And we are just super thankful here, all of us, the team in general, for Justin for giving us a hand. And when I say us, and when I say the team, I mean me. So I hope that you guys really found that instructive and interesting altogether, because for me, this was probably one of the most interesting courses that I've ever had. It really opened my mind to thinking in different terms when I program, when I solve problems, when I think about solutions, and that's what makes you a different engineer altogether. The other two paradigms, of course, are imperative and object-oriented, but since we already tackled those in previous videos, then I don't think for this particular course, they're really useful to explain. However, if we in the future have the necessity of going over some of these subjects, then of course, by all means, we can have another episode that really dives deep into imperative and object-oriented as well. But I think that this has been it for today, guys. I'm super happy to be back. I'm super glad that Justin has been able to be with us today. And I hope that you just have an amazing rest of your lives. Wash your hands, don't touch your face, and stay home for the time being. See you guys in the next one. Take care. Bye bye.